We acknowledge the Wadawurrung of the Kulin Nation as the traditional custodians of the land on which much of the history we cover in this series occurs. Indigenous history and traditions stretch back more than 60,000 years in Australia, and what little you'll hear of this in our series reflects that our ancestors often deliberately displaced or killed Indigenous people and suppressed their cultures. We pay our respects to the Wadawurrung elders, past, future, and emerging.
When a commission visited this asylum, one of the inmates of a cage-like enclosure grimly remarked that it was a place for the manufacture and not the cure of lunatics. 1886.
In May 1991, the Health Department initiated an investigation into Ararat. The task force found that Ararat provided neither a home-like environment nor conformed with the legislative principles. Ararat has barely changed since the last century. The problem is that staff have a vested interest in maintaining clients' dependency.
This episode contains references and direct examples of abuse in care occurring across the last 100 years in Victoria. Some listeners may find this material distressing. Listeners should be aware the language used in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to describe people with a disability is now highly offensive. While acknowledging that this is so, this episode retains the use of contemporary terms because they are revealing of past attitudes to and understandings of intellectual disability. Use of such terms has, however, been minimised where possible.
Hi, I'm David Waldron.
And I'm Tom Hodgson.
And welcome to Tales from Rat City. In this episode, we're going to be delving into the rather dark and disturbing past of Victoria's colonial lunatic asylums, built in the early 1860s to deal with the huge influx of population caused by the Victorian gold rush. This has also been particularly interesting as Jill Geiss's recent book, The Maddest Place on Earth, has talked about Victoria in this period having the highest rates of lunacy of any country on the planet. And there's particular histories to this that we'll delve into perhaps later on.
Does Jill talk about why we have the highest rates of lunacy at that time?
Well, what she talks about in particular is there are a lot of people from all over the world who thought they could dispense with relatives who had mental illnesses or were just inconvenient by sending them to the goldfields without adequate means of support. And these people would often end up in jails, in lunatic asylums and other places. The other thing, of course, is the kind of people who drop everything and leave are, of course, people who are struggling in other ways in their home countries.
Yeah.
Sure. Sometimes this is structural poverty, of course, such as particularly in Ireland, but in many cases it was like today, the same sort of people who can often unfortunately end up in jail when what's really going on is struggles of mental illnesses.
Ah, that's really cool. I did not read that article. I should have. What's interesting about this period is that the way mental asylums are set up in Victoria in the 1860s is in response already to a perceived failing of the mental health system in the UK. So the mental health system in the UK prior to the 1860s is pretty well known. It's Bedlam. It's the most famous mental asylum, if asylum's even the right word.
And Bedlam, of course, is regarded as notoriously dirty, cramped, chaotic, noisy and terrifying. And in the late 18th and early 19th century, there were things where, you know, bored onlookers could pay money to go in and observe the lunatics or sometimes watch them be beaten or tortured.
Yeah, so it's not, I mean, it's by no means an asylum, but it's definitely not healthcare. It's just a prison for people who are unable to look after themselves, for the most vulnerable people in society in some ways.
And since in the early colonial period, you have, of course, the Kew Asylum being, you know, one of the first built. But before then, there's all sorts of horrific stories, like in one case of people deemed to be lunatics being chained to rocks out in Port Phillip Bay and people coming and throwing them bits of bread and so on.
Oh, wow. Okay, that's dreadful.
Absolutely dreadful stories. But part of this, of course, is the changing perception of lunacy from a moral failing to people who suffer from an illness. And, you know, these asylums were built with what was considered cutting-edge technology at the time.
So we're talking about our asylums now.
Our asylums, yeah. They were built with cutting-edge technology at the time into creating what they hoped would become places where people could become well. And this is perhaps even really the first time people started really considering this, that mental illness was something that you could treat, you could care for, and in theory people could become better.
So is there a sense prior to that that it's a moral failing in that you're not strong enough to just survive in the world and that's your fault?
Yes, or that you're a sinner or you've fallen out of God's grace, or you've been touched by spirits. You know, this is really that transition period where for the first time people start to look at it scientifically. And while it might be pseudoscience from a modern point of view, nonetheless, this is people attempting to grapple with it as a secular issue that can be evaluated through medical science.
Cool. I mean, it's a start.
And so when you look at Ararat, Kew and Beechworth asylums, you know, this is a place you could take people out of the world, you know, through order, routine, comfort and care, they could be looked after. They had this idea that they could be put to work in the farms and fields and these places could become self-sufficient and through participating in this work they could become rehabilitated.
There's something when they describe the setups in the 1860s and 1870s when they're just building them and they haven't yet not worked, spoiler, there is something really modern and striking about how positive they sound like they could be, because there's this emphasis on the place being literally beautiful, like the gardens are a big emphasis, and there is, the, as you mentioned, self-sufficiency, which just seems oddly modern. The idea that, that it would be a working farm, that the people who lived there would grow their own food.
And the buildings are beautiful. They're built in that sort of Italianate style, and today they look like Gothic ruins, but at the time they were designed to be, you know, wonderful things to behold, to make you feel good about yourself. The early postcards of these asylums, they've taken a lot of pride in them. People are walking through the garden arm in arm. They're out there playing cricket in the field. It's, you know, idyllic the way they describe them.
And they definitely link, and it's, I don't want to say ahead of its time, because it just happened apparently to be the way they thought then. Like, it was right, and it's right now, that the environment was conducive to care. They were like, if we make this place calm, orderly, serene, and reliable and stable for these people, and it provides all of their needs, then perhaps that'll help them to have calm, orderly, stable minds. There's sort of a linkage here without the...
And also that Protestant idea too, that through the, you know, application of work, you become a better person.
Oh, yeah, right. Because you're working in the farm, because you're cleaning the place. You're not just locked in a room.
And you're developing, you know, useful skills, and you're applying yourself in, you know, work, and you feel good about, you know, engaging in work, you know, for your community.
At the new Ararat Asylum, the abutting wings and towers lend a pleasant effect, while the tall scattered chimneys which spring from the roof bestow a sense of comfort and pleasant habitableness to the place. Inside, a sense of order and repose will be preserved, which is not usually associated with the idea of bedlam.
So this idyllic discussions aside, very quickly problems began to emerge in the care of the lunatics of the time, as they were called. And in particular, there were problems where the level of self-care was such that self-sufficiency failed, which then meant there was a huge issue of budget problems, trying to fund asylums that weren't able to produce enough resources to look after their own clients. The number of lunatics was spiralling, and if you go to one of these asylums, particularly the Ararat one, you can see how the building, you've got the initial building complex, and then other buildings are just spawned off in all directions as the number of lunatics in care there stretched into the thousands.
There's a really interesting question here, and it's when you build an asylum and make it an environment that might be conducive to actual care and good outcomes, do you find more people with mental illness because finally there's somewhere for them to go? Or is it also what you were saying about people just, like, you know, you live anywhere in the world and you hear about the gold fields and you already maybe have mental health issues, it makes sense you could end up there.
Yeah, and there's also problems where, you know, there's social issues as well, where in a sense asylums became a vehicle of social control. For instance, you know, people who are campaigning for women's suffrage, for instance, get in the asylum.
Oh,
people who were socially inconvenient.
Homosexuals would go there. Yeah. It's more than just people with mental health issues. It's a dumping ground for, like, unwanted people and people with political views.
Yes, political views. Some people were kept there because they had issues speaking and communicating in English. So there's some interesting dynamics here. When I've been reviewing, records of seclusion, there's, like, a woman, for instance, at one point, and she's put in seclusion for 4 months. And you can see these at Melbourne Museum, and they're on the, you can look at the Victorian collections, and they're basically a 3-foot square box that stands about 6 feet tall, pitch black. And this woman was put in seclusion in this box for 4 months. Oh, and the reasoning given was she was too spirited.
What?
They said, what does too spirited
excitable?
Mean? excitable because they've got social perceptions of how a woman's meant to behave.
Oh, no. Okay, yeah.
Yeah. Similarly...
So is this how the justification for putting suffragettes in? It's like, you don't want the vote, you're mentally unwell and you have too much energy.
Yep. You might also be engaged in, for instance, licentious sexual behaviour, and you can go to lunatic asylum. Of course, people who are considered, you know, gay or trans, from today's point of view, would often end up in the asylum. Edward de Lacy Evans, we looked at in the previous episode, of course, was given that as a choice.
Yeah. You can stay dressed as the wrong gender in their terms, and we will keep you in the asylum, or you can go back to dressing as a woman and you'll be let out. Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
June 1883. Late on Friday evening last, two highly respected citizens of Ballarat called at the office of the Ballarat Star and brought to my notice a recently discharged inmate of the Ararat Lunatic Asylum residing in Eyre Street, who had some terrible stories to relate regarding the manner in which she alleged that patients were habitually treated there. I found Mrs. Cutler to be an intelligent-looking female of about 40 years of age. She seemed sensible and collected and told her terrible story without exhibiting any of that excitement which one would naturally expect to find in a woman who had only recently been discharged from a lunatic asylum and who might have had some grievance against the officials.
Please understand, sir, that I will gain nothing from this. I do not make these statements for my own benefit, but I have found in myself the deepest conviction that I must do something to relieve the sufferings of the sisters I left behind. A suffering caused by the inhumanity and brutality of some of the attendants who should be charged with crimes commencing with drunkenness and ending in matters altogether far graver. It is some of the attendants in the refractory ward who routinely abuse the women in their charge. This ward is where those of most intractable lunacy and those who are wayward, difficult, or troublemaking are consigned. These patients are abused daily, from their getting up in the morning until they retire to bed every night. Every morning the screams and yells of the patients were fearful to hear after the bell rang, when patients began to move out of bed. For should she not arise punctually at the appointed hour, a patient can expect to be dragged out of bed onto the floor by her hair or ears. Patients are often cruelly beaten with the bunch of keys attendants carry about their person when taken for their weekly bath. There is scarcely an inmate who undergoes the ordeal of the bath without being marked with bruises, their body discoloured from the effects of blows. I myself have been beaten and throttled when in the act of cleaning by several attendants. I was afterwards covered with bruises caused by the blows from these weapons.
Why did the matron or doctor not intervene?
Nothing I say is intended to implicate the matron or the medical superintendent. Both are kindly, but I believe they are being hoodwinked by the officials under them. A patient who has been beaten will often be removed by the attendants into some place of seclusion, there to remain until after the matron or medical superintendent has gone their usual rounds or until the marks have disappeared. On one occasion, I was able to bring another patient, Mary, to the doctor and show him the marks of her cruel mistreatment, but I do not know what steps he then took in this matter. Another abuse occurs by the theft of supplies and gifts intended for us patients. Clothing sent to me by my relatives never arrived. Our allowances of brandy and eggs are systematically taken by the attendants for their own use, and from this the attendants are frequently guilty of acts of drunkenness. During my 3-year incarceration in the asylum, I only received my allocation of brandy and sago on 5 occasions during the first fortnight, and eggs during the last week before my discharge. In the interim, I received none of these articles, although my husband was repeatedly informed they were included in my diet. What food we did receive was generally sent in, badly cooked, served in a dirty manner, and was not properly dished up. And should you refuse to eat the food, Two or three of the attendants gather around, one holding your nose while the others force food down your throat. This forcing process is so terrible and brutal that several female patients have died from it.
How can the staff so mistreat these women in their care without their husbands raising some alarm?
Well, many of these women are labourers' wives, and since committing their wives, the husbands have drifted away, not knowing and perhaps not caring the fate of their unhappy wives.
This subject was altogether too painful to further dwell upon. There is no one else to whom the patients have turned?
The attendants keep us under their thumbs. Patients who are seen as troublemakers are often treated with huge doses of salts, which weaken and render them less a nuisance to manage. They are dished out in large cups, and should even but a little be spilled, another dose equally as large will be forced on you. There is nothing medical in this treatment. I told the attendants when they were ill-treating me thus that when I once got out of the asylum, they had not seen the last of me.
And they let you leave?
After 2 painful years of existence in refractory, in January of this year I earned removal from that hellish ward and was sent to another part of the asylum, where the staff more kindly treated me and better looked after me.
We have given the patient's story as related to our reporter, removing the names and refraining from enlarging upon any of her allegations beyond merely stating what we consider to be necessary in the interest of the public.
The sympathetic reporter who was told to attend the ex-patient appears to have swallowed all her statements without much exercise of reason. The newspaper printed them with very little apology, only striving to make them appear as sensational as possible. A telegram or two to the Ararat Asylum, or to some responsible persons in Ararat, would have possibly put a different complexion upon them. The very knowledge that the woman had been incarcerated for insanity would have compelled a journal intelligently conducted to exercise care in receiving statements so sweeping in their charges of brutality and atrocity. But no such care was exercised, and the charges were put forward only to be contradicted. Inquiry would be a waste of public time and money, a report from the heads of the institution being all that is requisite on the subject. Patients cannot be choked to death or buried surreptitiously, or starved and beaten without the facts becoming known to the public living in the vicinity of the asylum, and, should even the slightest offence against the helpless lunatic patients be revealed, public opinion is apt to discover and quick to resent the crime. The World, 6th of June, 1883.
The report concerning the Ararat Lunatic Asylum, published in the Star of Monday last, has been the means of attracting a large amount of public attention to the subject. And while we are prepared to believe that not a little of what the ex-patient has said is exaggeration, we are of the opinion that a good deal of truth underlies the statement. It is difficult in a case of this kind to get reliable evidence, and no matter how perfect the cure effected, the testimony of the ex-patient will always be regarded with some amount of suspicion. On the other hand, we cannot say we have not heard vague rumours of practices somewhat similar to those which the ex-patient has published. And it is clearly the best course for patients, attendants, and the public that a thorough searching investigation be made. If we remember correctly, the story of the shower bath and the salts has been whispered abroad more than once, and the rumour of drunkenness among the staff is not a new one. It did not require the exercise of much thought to foresee the statement of Mrs. Cutler's would be contradicted by those implicated, but we aver that it remains yet to be elicited by a searching inquiry, not a sham one like many we have witnessed in this colony, whether the allegations of Mrs. Cutler are true. Ballarat Star, June 8th, 1883.
So one thing that's unclear, in Matilda's account, she gives the impression that the refractory ward is somewhere that people go because they're misbehaving. But later accounts I've read make it really clear that the refractory ward is somewhere you go by default at the beginning. So when you're first admitted to the asylum, you end up in the worst ward, and then you earn your way back to everywhere else, to the other wards.
One of the issues raised as well with this is the problem of attendance in these refractory wards, in that today, of course, to work in mental health requires a fair degree of training, there's a fair degree of supervision and so on, or at least dealing with acute cases of mental health. Mm. One of the issues raised here, of course, are the attendants. And attendants are often working extremely long hours. They're not particularly well trained. They're often paid quite poorly, which means you're attracting people who perhaps you really don't want to work with something sensitive like mental illness.
Yeah. Some of the most vulnerable people, for sure.
Now, Leanne Monk's research on this in Attending Madness, she talks about, you know, this. No, it's a complex situation. There's a lot of diversity in the types of care you had, and some people, of course, are better than others. But, you know, you can talk about people who, for instance, might be working 16 hours a day, living in the facility, overworked, not having any training.
Mm.
And it becomes, in a sense, you can understand how these pressures build up and you get poor behaviour.
Mm. And it's not to say it's justified, but it's one of these things you see time and time again across the last 150 years of care in Victoria, where when you cut training and resources and funding and people aren't valued for doing this incredibly difficult job, they in turn are much more likely to abuse those in their care.
Yeah. Well, I'll tell you a little anecdote here. My son, when he was like a baby, suffered very badly from eczema and he'd be screaming all night. And my wife and I would take turns every hour or so, you know, stroking his back, trying to keep him calm. And you'd start to feel after an hour angry despite yourself. You know, it's not their fault, but the frustration would build. And we could at least tag team and give each other respite. We pondered at the time what it would be like as a single parent wrestling with those issues.
Yeah.
You picture here, you're dealing with a client for huge amounts of periods of time. You're not having any relief or respite. You're working very long hours. What kind of things start to occur out of frustration? What kind of culture builds up among staff? Now, the last man hung in the Ballarat jail, Deutschman, 1908, actually worked as an attendant at the Arrow Lunatic Asylum, he killed his wife in a drunken rage. And one of the things that came in was alcoholism, frustration, leading to a lot of domestic altercations, culminating in murder.
Yeah.
Now, of course, this isn't any way to excuse him or what he did, but nonetheless, you can see this pattern of overworked, underpaid staff and being unable to separate themselves from their work by living on the premises.
I think the other thing that happens that you touched on there is that, as we've described it, is like an individual's experience of it, but then you set that in the context of decades of this, and it's the work culture. You go to this new job, you're not very well trained, so you don't know what to expect, and they teach you this is how we look after these people who are incredibly difficult. They are to be treated like less than regular humans, and if you show them empathy, they'll run a mile with it because they're the problem. And you know,
and you don't, if you have too much you know, if you have a very poor staff to patient ratio, it lends itself to treating patients
more
as
to
a block, and of course with this, of course, comes issues of overcrowding.
Yeah, for sure.
We have issues of typhus outbreaks and so on in the asylum. You know, it's described in the papers and things like, you know, excrement getting into the water system, leading to typhus outbreaks. You've got problems of food. There's letters there talking about, you know, we're receiving food that's not fit for pigs. There's problems of staff stealing food, you know. Like you get in any alienated workplace, people start stealing a little bit and then after a while it becomes endemic.
Like the culture, yeah, for sure.
Yeah. So, you know, there's some quite major issues. And Leanne Monk, again, talking about abuse and cruelty, discusses, like, when you read these, and I've got the actual records from the Arrow Asylum of complaints made against staff, and there are some horrific stories in there, but for the most part, what you've got are things like they only punish you for unwarranted use of violence, and then what she did is she cross-referenced the complaints with patient injuries, and you start getting suspicious amounts of things like fractured ribs.
Yeah.
Those sort of things. Or staff, a patient who's in a bed restrained, somehow getting fractured ribs.
Right.
You can see these.
Because the thing Matilda talks about that's really, you know, one of the hardest parts of her report is she talks about how it's routine that patients are beaten with keys during bathing, which seems so bizarre that it's hard to imagine why. But is that more about staff trying to control patients that they have no training and there's too many of them to do so? And it's just weirdly become cultural to beat them?
When you look at Cunningham Dax, who came in the 1950s, and he'd organised a collection of artefacts pertaining to the Arrowhead Asylum, and one of the things is staff making these very innovative homemade batons and things like out of tire leather and so on as vehicles to beat patients with.
Yeah, right.
And while I don't want to make the impression that, you know, all the patients are being beaten and so on, and certainly Matilda Cutler doesn't, nonetheless, the research indicates that this was
part of the culture. Yeah, that there was patients considered troublesome and that they would probably be routinely beaten, but then there would have been many patients who were considered non-troublesome and probably weren't.
And then, of course, we have things, things like sexual abuse, and this can be quite complex as well. Like, one of the things they talk about was, how do they put it, ungentlemanly conduct resulted in several pregnancies in the women's ward.
And people are so vulnerable.
And in the report on it, like, these things are actually mentioned in the complaints made against staff. One staff member is dismissed for sleeping with multiple patients. In terms of that culture of dependency and helplessness, they said in many cases the women weren't necessarily unwilling, but they were so bored that any... The other thing they also found was, you know, if you're suffering from poor food and so on, getting on the right side of the doctor means you can get better quarters, better food, and it's that culture of dependency and insecurity and desperation.
The other thing that came out from some of the reading I've done that isn't mentioned by Matilda is that those refractory wards and those wards where people who were considered troublesome were put, because you kind of wonder then, like, surely there's some oversight here. Those wards were off limits. So if you visited as an official observer, which Sox will talk about shortly during the report that he does into asylums, or if you visited as, you know, the head of asylums or anyone, even a family member, you would never be taken into those areas. So everything you see is the patients who are who have been indoctrinated and institutionalized into behaving, sometimes by being beaten, and not the places where that's still occurring. And Matilda's case in that way is exemplary. Like, she is not unique, but her particular pathway through the organisation may have exposed her to more or less cruelty than others. It's really hard to say.
The other thing is, because she's so articulate, I think it particularly galvanises public attention, because you've got a spokesperson talking about abuse in care who is articulating herself very well. She's very aware of the issues. Mm. She comes across well-spoken.
It's interesting you say that, because one of the other things that does happen that I found really jarring as a modern reader is that account you've just heard is the only time you hear from her, and from then on after this, all the newspapers print is officials, journalists' opinions, or her husband. She doesn't get interviewed ever again, which is bizarre.
One thing about her story is it does galvanise public opinion, and this is already gaining national attention, even with similar stories coming out in asylums in South Australia and New South Wales, and in other, of course, other asylums in Victoria.
So it's, you know, across the nation. It's certainly not Ararat, Beechworth alone. Yarra alone.
And, you know, in the Victoria's case, this leads to the point where they start pushing for an inquiry into abuse in care.
Right. It's in the media. It's in everyone's awareness. They have to do something. So there are enough concerns raised that the Victorian Premier appoints the member for East Melbourne, Ephraim Zox, to conduct a royal commission in 1884. And the report of this is released in 1886. The one other thing I want to mention before we get into the Zox report, which is this, as we kind of indicated at the start, these terms used for mental illness and mental health at this time that to modern ears sound like the doctors are just writing these people off. So I'm thinking things like idiot. But the context of the time is that these are medical terms. And what's happened is, and this happens all the time, it's actually called the euphemism treadmill. It's really interesting. So doctor or care practitioners in the mental health realm, just for example, will set a term like idiot, and they'll say this describes this particular kind of mental health, and then it becomes public knowledge and the public use it derogatively, and then over time even the medical term sounds weird and offensive, and we switch to a new term. And that is just a natural sort of process that occurs all the time with so many things. There's a really bizarre specific example of this in Adelaide, where I'm from, which has just turned into Adelaide slang. I grew up next to a place called Minder Home, which is a mental health institution, and was historically. And in the area of Adelaide I live, Minder is very offensive slang for someone with a mental illness, exactly because of this place. So it's kind of slipped into public use, and then, you know, the names change. So when you listen to Zox Report, and when you listen to any healthcare professional in this episode, at the time they're speaking, what they're saying isn't necessarily making them a bigot. It is the view they have of things, and it is in some ways pseudoscientific. They don't really know that much about mental health, but they're not calling them idiots. They're calling them a mental health label that is appropriate in the context of the era.
According to the evidence taken by Your Excellency's Commission, the treatment in our asylums for the cure of the insane is very defective. The classification is bad in every sense of the term. Newly arrived patients are put into the refractory wards when, according to the best authorities and the admission of the inspector, insanity in the early stages is in its most critical state, the patients requiring skillful, experienced, humane, and gentle treatment. Persons who have never been guilty of any offence against the state have to herd with people who have committed serious crime. One of the most painful features of mental disease is want of sleep. Yet the accommodation is so defective that the noisy patients cannot be properly isolated, while overcrowding has been the almost chronic state of the asylum for the last 30 years. Regular journals of the treatment adopted in dealing with each patient ought to be kept, but are not. The medical officers, as we are advised, have not enough time to devote to the proper care of the insane. And, on the evidence of one excellent and reliable witness, there is a chance of patients who require regular and careful attention being lost in the crowd and drifting into chronic insanity. When the commission visited this asylum, one of the inmates of a cage-like enclosure grimly remarked that it was a place for the manufacture and not the cure of lunatics.
One of the things Zoxis finds during his report is effectively that the asylums are keeping this huge class of people who do not need to be there. He'll emphasize again and again that an asylum is interchangeable with a prison. It shouldn't be, but it is, and there's nothing he can do about it. They take away people's freedoms. And because freedom is such a high, we put such a high value on freedom in our society, accurately and reasonably, people who do not need to be there should not be. We should be giving them, in modern terms, the dignity of risk to go out and sort of see how they go, and if they don't make it, fine, they can come back. But it's not appropriate to keep them if they're high functioning. And so one of his significant recommendations is that people, a large amount of these patients are taken out of the asylum he's trying to find an alternative. And what he comes up with is this boarding out system where people are put in the homes of strangers, and those people, regular members of the community, are paid to look after them or paid to have them in their own home.
In fact, I think he refers to, again, studies in Britain, which were indicating, a lot of this is 1886, and he's talking about community and cottage-based care being vastly superior for most patients.
Yeah. I mean, it's got its own issues, and it needed more work than I think the model that Ephraim Zox proposes shows, but it's already in place in Europe. It's vastly better, and ultimately it's what we do, but 120 years later.
Yeah, very much so.
We have five large establishments, and they are all too much like jails. For a very large percentage of our insane population, we are quite sure no restraint is necessary, and yet they are all confined together under a system that must be monotonous and oppressive. The principle which at present regulates admissions and discharges seems to be this: not easily in, and still less easily out. The primary object of asylums is the cure of insanity. It is the secondary objective of asylums which makes them places of care for the insane, and this strictly applies only to those who, though incurable, cannot be restored to liberty because they are dangerous to themselves or others, or because for any other reasons their safety and comfort cannot be elsewhere provided for. Members of parochial boards too frequently draw conclusions on this subject from hurried visits. They are satisfied if they see clean wards and sufficiently clothed inmates, but they do not realise the weary monotony of the patient's existence. Their prolonged confinement to rooms, the clean bareness of which is in itself chilling and depressing, their scanty exercise in narrow yards, and the feeling of injustice which such treatment frequently engenders in the minds of those in whom disease has not altogether destroyed the power of reflection. Under our present system, the infirm and imbecile are under lock and key, and we treat people who are fit to be boarded out as if they were prisoners not worthy to be trusted at large. A doctor may rightly think that a patient who has nearly recovered, or who is semi-insane and harmless, is not fit to engage in the struggle for life. But all good and strong grounds for the forcible detention having been removed, the time has arrived when the patient should be allowed to choose. And if he prefers to enjoy his sacred liberty, with all its risks and troubles, no door should bar his outlet. What very many persons do not appear to us to properly realise is the sacredness of the liberty of the subject. A man's liberty ought to be almost as much valued as his life, and only under the direst necessity should he be deprived of one or the other. We do not disguise from ourselves the fact that asylum authorities in general are not in favour of the boarding out system. They admit the advantages of the plan in the abstract, but overloaded with doubts and difficulties that are calculated to cast grave misgivings as to its feasibility.
The boarding out systems is certainly worthy of a fair trial, though various considerations occur to suggest difficulties. The ruling incentive to strangers to receive lunatics into their families would surely be self-interest. They would expect to be recompensed for their trouble, either by an equivalent in money or by services rendered by the patient.
Very true. But this must apply in all cases. The caretakers of asylums are not disinterested philanthropists.
Doubtless persons could be found whom a moderate contribution of money might induce to undertake such a responsibility. But, as has been pointed out in former reports, the number of such persons in a community like ours is problematical.
Well, of course every suggestion is problematical until it is put to the test. If there are only a few persons in this community who would take such responsibility, there is an end to the matter.
It is to be remembered also that hitherto relatives and friends have removed patients in considerable numbers, independently of any pecuniary inducement. The question arises whether these guardians might not claim payments allowed to strangers, and whether they might not successfully resist the responsibility of caring for their insane relatives.
The short answer to the fears expressed by the inspector is this. Persons entitled to be paid for the keep of insane friends should be paid, whether relatives or not. Persons not entitled to payment should not be paid, and persons who refuse to discharge their duties should be compelled to do so. All these considerations may involve difficulty, but none that cannot be overcome.
Nor is it to be forgotten that the patients so removed would consist of the least troublesome or most useful portion of inmates, and in proportion as they left the asylum, so would the efficiency of the staff be diminished. At present, the staff is in the proportion of 1 to every 10 patients, but if the boarding out systems were to result, as is probable, in removing the best class of patients, such a proportion of staff might be found insufficient for the care and control of those who would be left.
If the Commission had attempted to elicit this evidence by direct questions, we should have failed in the effort. It is in effect urged that the least troublesome, most useful and best class of patients should not be boarded out because they are useful. In the course of our investigations, we have heard it stated that patients are detained because they are useful. But we never expected that the Inspector of Asylums would admit and suggestively urge this as a reason why the boarding out system should not be adopted. How are you to know if a patient is to be capable of living beyond the walls of an asylum? The answer is simple. Give him a trial. Many unpromising cases have known to benefit so much by the change that they would scarcely have been recognized. We feel morally certain that if very many of the inmates of our asylums had friends rich enough to bring their cases before the Supreme Court, the judges would unhesitatingly order their release. Not that they are sane, but because the reasons for their prolonged detention are wholly inadequate.
I recall a section in the Zocs report, and it says, you know, he talks about the large number of women who are locked up for things like moral insanity, or dipsomania, or alcoholism, or, you know, having unusual behaviour characteristics but are perfectly functional. He says, you know, these women, they clean the bedpans, they run the gardens, they care for the animals, they'll do the winery, they'll clean the walls. He said, if they can do all these jobs unsupervised, why on earth do they need to be in the care of the state?
And the obvious answer.
Yeah, well, he says the issue is that they were less likely to free these women than women with serious mental conditions, because the women with serious mental conditions require resources and funding and a hard work. Whereas these other women are held precisely because they do all this unpaid labour that allows the asylum to function.
That's an outrage.
Yeah.
You understand that if you see a patient with rheumatism, another with inflammation of the lungs, and another with a broken leg, you can recollect each of those and carry in your mind the state of the patient, or write it down in a notebook. But when you see 400 people, all with lunacy, you can see the immense difficulty to demonstrate whether those people are better or worse from day to day. And that is the enormous difficulty that a medical man in an asylum has. Let them write down what notes they like, and let them be so ever capable. They have no parallax to go on. And that is the reason why they think people are insane, and why they continue to think it.
One of the other things Zox goes into in his report that I've trimmed out here, it's kind of long, is that he talks about the great difficulty of medical men to agree on cases of insanity. What he's trying to sort of touch on is that at the time the science of mental health is virtually non-existent, and so you can go to any different doctor in the colony of Victoria, and one of them may say this person's insane and the other may say they're not. Now, the reason this really matters is because a doctor declaring someone insane puts you in an asylum, potentially for life, and certainly it'll be on your record. So they are judge and jury and, you know, prison guard for a system, but they cannot actually assess insanity very reasonably. Mm. So he says the best thing we could do is to set up something called a receiving house. So we can't fix doctors not being very good at this, but we can give them multiple opportunities to do it by, instead of taking someone who may be needing a bit of extra care and putting them immediately into asylum, we put them temporarily into a receiving house, and each week they're there, they get reassessed. And as soon as then a doctor says, I'm actually not sure they're insane, oop, they go out. But after a month, if no one says that, okay, now they go on to an asylum. They've been assessed for a significant period of time rather than one snapshot.
There's also issues too raised in the papers at this time of, you know, people abusing the asylum system by, for instance, getting rid of inconvenient wives or, you know, daughters who are pregnant out of wedlock. And those issues get, you know, they're certainly raised in the papers. And there's questions like, if you have a doctor who you have some holdover, this creates, you know, potential for abuse, but also potential for abuse that draws on the resources of the state it shouldn't have to pay.
I'm really glad you mentioned that. There's a remarkable moment that I had spent days thinking about in the Matilda Cutler newspaper segment, where she says, since committing their wives, these husbands have drifted away, not knowing and perhaps not caring the fate of their unhappy wives. And the reporter says, the subject was altogether too painful to further dwell upon. And I couldn't understand what he meant by that. But what he's saying is, Matilda, my best guess, then went on to explain that possibly men were putting their wives in asylums to get rid of them. And he found this so difficult to understand, which is interesting because he describes in detail, and I edited it out because I felt it was too much for us to cover, he describes in detail how a woman died in the asylum from abusive care during a feeding routine, which is grim reading. And yet he is sort of circumspect about explaining that he thinks that husbands may be deliberately dropping their wives in asylums.
And this is that thing too, like it threatens that whole structure and institution of marriage, which in the Victorian period was seen as the cornerstone of society.
Right.
And if you have scenarios where husbands are dealing with inconvenient wives by putting them in asylum so they can chase another woman or something, it becomes, you know, an appalling concern.
Like it undermines
The whole institution of marriage.
Point of society.
And it's unfortunate too in this period that that's what they're concerned about as well, not the abuse of care.
Yeah, not the fact that people might be dying, but the fact that people might be leaving their husbands.
Or
sort of an indirect divorce is occurring via asylum. Mm. And that these women are just languishing there for no good reason.
Yeah, and it's a funny thing that's constantly come through with me with the literature on this particular episode is the extent to which it becomes time and time again about the control of and abuse of women particularly. It just constantly comes up through the literature and material.
In the course of our inquiry, innumerable complaints and allegations have been made. But it is almost needless to say that the exact truth could not be discovered unless we had been prepared to sit from day to day and do nothing but hear complaints. Our object has been to learn what organic changes are necessary for the better management of the whole establishment.
After noting that there are these complaints that he won't kind of go into, and I'm confident this includes Matilda Cutler, so Zox kind of glosses over this and says, we don't need to go into these individual cases. They're a matter for, you know, the police or the asylum system to look into. I'm here to look at systematic reform. And, okay, there's maybe some argument to that. He does note a few things. He notes a particular doctor who is tyrannical, overbearing. His conduct is being reviewed as part of the investigation. He notes that asylums are dirty, that there's financial mismanagement, and he thinks it's got to be either incompetence or corruption. Either way, unacceptable. He says clothing is insufficient and badly made, and because there's so little of it given to patients, what they have is almost always dirty. Mm. And he is emphatic that there are patients being employed to do private work of the attendants and sort of filling that gap the way you mentioned, and that the food is prepared improperly with defective kitchen equipment and bad food. And he ends with these 65 recommendations for change. So the question is, what changed? You know, did this get fixed?
Well, it's interesting when you look at Cunningham Dax coming in to run the Victorian asylum system in the 1950s. One of the things he identifies was, for instance, children with Down syndrome were wearing ill-fitting pants and donated football jerseys from a local football club. That, you know, many of these problems have come back, are no different. Patient talks about patients spending very little work was being done to actually rehabilitate patients. Patients spending hours in seclusion or in straitjackets in their rooms, not much happening. And, you know, he talks about these new facilities that were there that were cutting edge, built in the late 19th century, that were appalling and falling apart and so on in the 1950s. Mm. And he talks about these, you know, really awful structural issues. And then he said it was basically kept functioning by the hard work of volunteers. But he talked about one woman, for instance, being put in charge of bathing 40 children with Down syndrome.
Oh, wow.
As a volunteer.
Yeah.
And the volunteers were so dedicated because they'd formed attachments to these patients.
Oh, yeah, okay. This is kind of classic, actually, and they were, as a problem. Yeah.
And they were, you know, drawing far too much on them, and these poor volunteers are, you know, falling apart. But they wouldn't leave because they, you know, had formed personal attachments, and so they're being exploited.
Yeah, absolutely.
In fact, there's a lot of these, you know, things you're talking about in the 1880s that, again, don't get resolved into the 1990s or even today. Mm. I mean, funny thing with the Ararat Asylum, one of the things coming out of this report is they decide to separate the criminally insane from the normal patients.
That's one of the things they actually do, yeah.
Yeah, and so they set up a temporary measure of putting these criminally insane patients in the Ararat jail, and that becomes J Ward, which lasts for a century, a temporary measure that lasts for a century.
Right, yeah.
You know, there's the really strange ad hoc systems that are a combination of poor planning and bad budgeting. I mean, the first HIV patients are sent to J Ward.
Why?
Well, there were perceived to be at that stage a threat to the public. There was all that stigma, of course, about AIDS and those appalling ads with the Grim Reaper throwing bowling balls at people in random. So they put them in with the criminally insane.
I mean, yeah, that's... Why not even just... okay.
Strange temporary measures that are...
That become the norm.
Become the norm for over a century. It's... bizarre decision making. One of the things I find time and time again when you look at the literature, particularly on the Ararat Asylum, was that you got this, you know, scandal leading to a huge influx of funds, followed by chipping away at those funds over time until things reach a state where there's another scandal breaks and there's another injection of funds. And, you know, the Zox report, you know, there's a scandal, we have the Zox report, there's a big injection of funds, new buildings get built, then of course First World War, the Depression, Second World War, by the time 1950s have occurred, it's in an awful state again.
It's just as bad, if not worse, yeah. What specifically gets fixed after Zox that I've read into, they, as you mentioned earlier, they provision off separate places for the criminally insane, but even then they acknowledge it's a temporary measure and then they do it for 50 years. So that's,
do it for a century.
Sorry, 100 years.
Yeah.
So that's J Ward. They do add additional accommodation in residences to alleviate overcrowding, but guess what? They fill up, so overcrowding becomes a problem again. They attempt the boarding out system, but patients are reluctant to be away from friends and family and in a stranger's home, and there's no more than 30 at any given time in the next 50 years patients who are actually in boarding out care, because asylum officials are also unwilling to let them go. They say, oh, we're not confident this is a good system. So it doesn't happen, really. And yet that system, as you mentioned, had been established in Europe, so it seems likely it could have been successful. And there was legislative reform. So one of the things Vox talks about that we've covered off in there a little bit is that it was so difficult to, like, over-supervise the staff who were problematic. Like, they couldn't be fired. It was really hard to have a sense of what was going on. I mean, that all comes back to underfunding and lack of training, but there were clearly people who needed to be got rid of.
Yeah, and if you read the complaints records of the time, the complaints I have there from, you know, 1870 through to World War One at Ararat, there's an awful lot of staff who are using patient medications for personal recreational use.
Right.
There's a lot of thievery. There's a lot of drunk or high on duty.
Mm.
And, like, you know, there's a few graphic, awful cases, but for the most of them, you've got this stuff that speaks of appalling morale.
Mm.
There's also a few cases of staff helping patients to escape.
Oh, really?
Which I find very interesting.
That's telling.
Like, I don't know what their personal stories are. I just have the description in the complaints book.
I'd love to find out more about that.
What's happening?
Yeah. The other thing that Zox mentions, the receiving houses. So the legislation's passed to bring them into existence, but then, as you mentioned, there's an economic depression in the 1890s, and then, you know, there's the actual Great Depression, and then there's the World Wars, so they don't get built. They bring a teacher in to sort of bring more activities for the people who were in the asylum, but the teacher's fired after a single year, and the disappointment of the staff and patients is expressed really, really clearly, like that they thought this was really worth doing, and yet they couldn't keep one teacher on staff. So all these asylums have to trim budgets and trim staff constantly as these sort of things bite, and no one ever brings money back to asylums. Mm. You know, they're not voting. And so, yeah, patient labour becomes more and more used again.
There's also the problem, too, of stigma of mental illness. And like raised with Matilda Cutler, if you're mentally ill and you're making complaints about abuses in care, who's going to believe you, especially in this period?
Right, right. There's that thing where they sort of say, well, what? Okay, of course you'd come out and say everything was there was a conspiracy to harm you. You are a former mental patient. You know, how can we believe your account? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what happens to Matilda?
For unknown reasons, Matilda's readmitted to the Ararat Asylum in November of 1896. And we don't really know why. They talk about that she damaged her clothing and some of the Manchester and so on, but we don't really know what the issue is. Mm. And there's interesting things too, like let's say, for instance, she had a nervous or anxiety-related issue, she'd still be fully articulate in describing things, yet, you know, maybe prone to these fits. But again, we don't know.
Yeah.
But she dies in the Ararat Asylum itself on the 4th of February 1903 at age 64.
Yeah, I mean, the real gut punch of it is that she got out and spoke really eloquently about these issues, led to a huge report and all this attention on it. And then when she ultimately needed care again and went back into the institution, at the time that she did, it would have been no better at all.
In the coroner's report, it simply says heart failure, but in a sense, it's often what they do for people in this situation, because in a sense, everyone dies of heart failure in the end.
Right, right. It's like saying someone died of losing oxygen to the brain. It's like, it's just, yeah, yeah. This is how you die. Yeah.
So we don't know the specific circumstances that led to this occurring.
So this brings us to 1991, and you would think by then things would be better. And to just double down on the content warning we opened with, we're going to be talking about abuse in and out of care, and the content might be confronting and triggering for some. We're not going to name or give identifying specifics when discussing anyone accessing or working in the contemporary mental health system for the confidentiality of all involved.
In May 1991, the Health Department initiated an investigation into Ararat in relation to specific allegations of sexual abuse of patients and clients, and generally into the provision of services. Specific allegations of prostitution rackets, sexual offences by staff, and management cover-ups were not supported by either the investigation of the task force or of the Victorian police. However, clients regularly engaged in sexual activity, some of it inappropriate. Whilst the investigation of specific allegations did not reveal persistent and systemic physical abuse of clients by staff, it did reveal a complacency that resulted in the failure to recognise a duty of care. As a result, clients' rights were infringed and their dignity abused.
The 1991 report is very hard reading. It's interesting where he talks about, you know, specific allegations of prostitution rackets and sexual offences not being supported by the investigation, but when you read the chapter in the report entitled Specific Allegations, it's very disturbing where there are things like one particular claim that a staff member was prostituting women from one of the wards to his friends who were volunteers and other friends he had in the community. They described, for instance, quite a violent sexual assault, and the reason not to pursue, given by the Ararat police at the time, was that the exchange of cigarettes occluded the issue of consent, in that one of the women was expecting cigarettes after this sexual assault. And this person who witnessed it, the kind of trauma that that would occur, and some of the, you know, some of the things leading to that in particular investigation were staff talking about women trying to make themselves look unattractive so they wouldn't be selected.
Mm.
You know, and these stories are all there. And to say you're not going to investigate because the exchange of cigarettes occludes the issue of consent and, hey, they're mentally ill, like, this is, you know,
I finished high school in 1992. This should be the modern era. Yeah. I'm reading this and it's just appalling. Another case, they said that the person making the report wasn't doing so in their capacity as a staff member at the Ararat Asylum. Again, how on earth does that warrant not investigating this fully? So while it makes that claim, I have real doubts about whether we can accept the validity of the idea that these claims remained unproven, in that they don't seem to have been investigated, and simply saying exchange, you know, you can't have consent if a person's under a prison-like scenario.
Mm, yeah, I mean, let alone if they have mental illness, depending on what's going on there, yeah.
The task force repeatedly observed that there are significant numbers of ambulant, apparently high-functioning clients with little to do. This lack of occupation often manifests in sexually inappropriate behaviour, and often behaviours euphemistically called challenging by staff. These challenging behaviours are used by staff to justify the clients remaining in an institutional environment. The problem is that staff have a vested interest in maintaining clients' dependency. There is a clear perception by staff and the local community that further reduction of existing client numbers will actively threaten employment. Although the buildings have been maintained and attempts at refurbishment have been made, it is a far cry from normal. Ararat has barely changed since the last century. The task force found that Ararat provided neither a home-like environment nor conformed with the legislative principles. There is almost no privacy, even in the ablution facilities. The social and recreational areas are barren, uninteresting places with little in the way of gardens, trees, or seating. One of the few changes over the last century has been to stop nearly all client participation in daily chores. These services are now performed by a large number of non-direct care staff. The effect of this is to disenfranchise higher functioning clients from participating in or contributing to their own living conditions. It is dependent on which ward the client lives in as to whether he or she will have access to his or her own underwear, or whether the underwear for all the people in the ward is pooled. There is almost no consistent or meaningful work, education or recreational activity provided at Ararat. By and large, most clients wander aimlessly around the grounds or sometimes downtown. Residents and patients provide 74% of their pensions as part of payment for food and board. Few residents receive their own money in cash. Most have their money placed in a ward pool for purchasing a wide range of items at the discretion of the staff. Much of this money has been spent on additional items for general consumption. Some has been spent on household cleaning agents. On the occasions a resident or patient goes on holidays or day outings, he or she contributes to all costs, apart from salary, of the accompanying staff, including hotel bills, drinks, and meals. On these trips, staff keep all client monies in cash and dole it out or spend it how they see fit. Staff can rarely account properly for how the client's money is spent. Some pooled client funds were spent on basic food items such as milk and fruit to supplement an inadequate diet. The task force is concerned at the high number of underweight clients. It appears that some clients are not receiving enough food, or alternatively, they are so bored with the lack of variety in the weekly menu that they do not eat every meal. The average weight of the male resident between 30 and 70 years of age in December 1989 was 57.78 kilograms. Financial control and accountability is either non-existent or ineffective. Stock control is non-existent. The task force found that 20 to 50% of some items of food purchased by Ararat did not reach the client's plate. The task force considered that the only rational explanation for the unaccounted food is large-scale, systemic pilfering by staff. Dental care is seriously deficient. Many patients and residents are without either their own teeth or false teeth. Ararat does not supply money for dentures. Many of the shortcomings in daily care, programs, sustenance, and shelter were blamed on lack of resources. The task force completely rejects this. It cost $18 million to run Ararat in 1990-91. In June 1991, there was 188 intellectually disabled residents and 57 psychiatric patients. That is, it costs an average of $70,000 per client per annum. A casual observer of the clients of Ararat would have trouble understanding where the money went to. By way of comparison, it costs approximately $17,000 per annum for a child to be educated at the most expensive private boarding school in the state, and approximately $35,000 per annum for 24-hour nursing care for a dependent aged person. Ararat employs 455 staff for its 245 clients. Over 40% are employed in non-direct care duties. 14 years ago, 420 staff cared for 621 clients. Despite the large number of staff employed, for 12 hours each night, less than 20 staff are on duty. For the intellectually disabled residents, this in effect means being custodially contained in a locked ward between 7:56 p.m. and 7 a.m. each night.
One of the things the report makes fairly clear is this very strange relationship between the community of Ararat and the asylum. So the asylum is the biggest employer in Ararat and makes up a really important part of their economy. So there's a vested interest in finding as much work as possible for people of Ararat in or around the asylum, not to the benefit of the patients. In fact, there's a vested interest, therefore, in not ever letting anyone out if you can avoid it, because one less client may mean one less worker. So there's that shocking fact he gives about the number of staff they have, where the clients have gone down and they have even more staff. And then, so that kind of leads to this question of, does the Ararat community sort of close ranks and try and protect themselves from these claims?
Well, it raises interesting questions with the police force in that respect.
That's what I'm kind of thinking.
There's also an interesting thing too, because it's been the major employer in the town for over a century.
Yeah.
You know, gold ran out in Ararat fairly quickly. And in a sense, it's become like one of those prison towns in the United States where the prison essentially becomes
the main economy.
And, you know, that has to feed through so much of the social infrastructure of the town and the community. And it's interesting, when you visit the site today in tourism, you have essentially ghost tours at night that bring out, you know, every horrible thing that's ever happened there, because it's selling ghost tours, of course. You go there through the day and the tours there are comparatively positive, and it talks about where patients would play cricket and so on. And it's important perhaps too to note that for all the horrors we've talked about today as well, it's a huge institution with a complex history. Some people had these awful experiences. Some people, you know, played cricket and, you know, functioned well.
And different times for different journeys for different patients may have been relatively benign, and they may have found a benefit in the care. But, yeah, obviously the systems.
And also depending which periods, like the early years with Cunningham Dax versus...
Or just after 1887, you know, probably substantially better than 1890 when Matilda goes back here.
Very much so. So there's a pattern at work here. This fix and forget. You know, you build with the best of intentions. You try and deal with scandal and chronic failings by investing in new infrastructure, new facilities, new resources. You know, it can look like a great example, but then there's not that sustained funding. It reminds me of a friend of mine who was working with dealing with child soldiers. And she talked about this problem where there's huge amounts of money finding child soldiers in Africa and bringing them into Western countries and so on. But she said finding funding for long-term rehabilitation and care and counselling is almost non-existent.
Right.
Which means in practice what you're doing is getting traumatised children who've been through things you can't imagine, and then you're popping them in schools with little support.
That leads to problems.
And it's a similar thing here. There's all this funding up front when there's a scandal, but the problem of sustaining funding becomes critical. And this leads to those, you know, systemic long-term problems of, you know, using clients as staff, you know, using clients' money to cover other running costs, the problems of insufficient oversight, the problems of lack of staffing, problems of food. You know, they start to trim things here and there, and before you know it, people are eating, you know, old rice with weevils in it.
So in 1993, the Victorian government brings 130 years of institutions to an end, closing them and moving patients into a different care model. community care and care homes. Recently, the system has again been overhauled with the introduction of the National Disabilities Insurance Scheme, the NDIS. Researching this section, I spoke to people who have experienced the contemporary mental health system as patients and as professional workers in the greater Ballarat area. So I think an interesting starting point is to ask how today would Matilda Cutler have fared? We do not know the details of Matilda's psychological health, but it seems likely her condition fluctuated across her lifetime. So for the purposes of this hypothetical, let's say there were times when she was suffering acute psychological illness and really did need significant care, and other longer periods when she was sufficiently well to care for herself. This is common with many mental health conditions. Our 2019 Matilda is also supported by her husband and has friends in the Ballarat community, consistent with in the 1870s. She's connected into a wider community. So during Matilda's more stable spells, she could access care in 2019 through specialists like local psychologists. But what about her acute spells? In the current system, we have one such place that's still akin to an old asylum. That is acute mental health crisis services, which are usually a sectioned off inpatient ward in a larger hospital. Ballarat Hospital has one of these. It only accepts people suffering acute psychosis or at risk of suicide. So this is people who are a threat to themselves or others. They are pretty grim places. Patients are usually in isolation, and someone I know who's been in one of these describes the noise levels as inimical to sleep. Because, of course, these places are designed only for extremely short-term stays. It's like, are you well enough to not be a threat? Okay, off you go.
I've certainly had that, having someone I know in a very difficult situation, I was having to care for them, and it was only when I mentioned their suicidal discussion and so on that they're able to get any support at all. And then support happened, but it was only for like a day.
Yeah.
And then they had an evaluation going, okay, they passed this acute phase and off they went again.
Yeah.
But this person had a long period of systemic issues of psychotic episodes, sometimes relating to charges and so on, suicidal episodes pertaining to their quite severe mental health issues, and getting that sustained care was just not feasible.
Like, I used to work in extensively in disability, so I've often worked with people with mental health as a serious issue who are in and out of personal crisis. And I had a client who was repeatedly making threats of self-harm and suicide, and I contacted the same sort of emergency intake, and they said, oh yeah, they say that all the time. The reaction was, oh, well, if they, like, we've taken them and we've assessed that they're okay enough to be in the community, so there's nothing we can do for this person who is repeatedly threatening harm. And, you know, I don't have that client anymore, that nothing came of it that I know of, but they clearly needed help of some regard.
You have people in 1886 saying, you know, cottage and community-based care can, you know, for most clients be wonderful, but what happened in practice was the ideology of deinstitutionalization was used as a fundraising measure without the resources being put in place to sustain those people.
And then where do you go? If you're Matilda Cutler, you have family and friends. And even if in that moment you don't have the wherewithal to look after yourself as best as possible, Matilda had that network, and she can resume seeing her normal healthcare professionals. So here is the issue, here is the gap. What if your mental health is sufficiently bad that you're intermittently or constantly unable to function appropriately in normal society, but you're not rated as sufficiently a risk to yourself or others to end up in this acute care? And what if you've no supports, no family, not educated like Matilda seems to be, and not mentally competent enough to recognize that you might need to access help? Remember, Matilda didn't raise the alarm for herself. She's more concerned for her sisters in the asylum. She likely recognized there were far more vulnerable people than her. What happens to the kinds of people who actually needed the protection that a properly functioning asylum was supposed to afford when the asylum system ended? People I've spoken to who have experienced the current mental health system, both as professionals and clients, told me, for people like that, who really require supervision and care long-term, there is almost nothing. This is a minority, but it is the most vulnerable minority within an already vulnerable group. These are people who cannot hold down a job, who have complex histories of trauma and abuse, who are often unable to recognize they need help or make safe decisions for themselves. These people are very, very likely to be people you see sleeping rough. They are likely to be stealing food, begging for money, and given their extreme vulnerability and the kinds of places they're trying to live, be that a boarding house or the street, they're extremely likely to have experienced physical and sexual abuse, which brings with it further trauma and complications to their treatment and care. in these horrible circumstances, which would be trying to anyone, they are also very likely to be exposed to drugs and alcohol, and understandably, addiction and substance abuse are common. For these kinds of people, asylums have been replaced by homelessness or prison. So why is this happening? One issue is that government housing services are extremely underfunded. So these kinds of people bounce between boarding houses and rentals and nothing. Often they end up blacklisted by the few non-governmental housing services available, places which are not run by professional social workers or people trained in mental health anyway. A classic Ballarat example is Reed's Guest House. And because these people need so much additional support and their behaviour is so challenging, they are extremely difficult for these untrained staff to deal with. So what's needed for these people? Something you can't be evicted from, with both supporting workers and some sort of community within it, so you're not isolated. In other words, a safe refuge from the world until you are hopefully able to return. An asylum. So when we look back at 130 years of asylums and the many people they failed and who suffered abuse in these institutions, are we maybe overlooking perhaps that there was something in the model that was right? If the place had been funded correctly, was there a kind of patient who needed them?
This sometimes makes you ponder too, like with asylums and so on, if they were able to keep the funding up, would it have necessarily been as appalling?
My impression, honestly, is that it had legs. Like, I think they shut it in response to 130 years of mismanagement and abuse without possibly noticing that there were ways in which it should have worked and left us with a gap.
And when you look at all these cases of abuse, it comes down to, you know, overworked, underpaid staff, lack of resources for proper supervision.
Right.
Yeah, you know, lack of facilities, food, all those resources. But it always comes down to lack of funding as the primary cause of these issues. And then this relates to contemporary issues of things like abuse in care and so on, again, coming down to lack of funding. And this creates an interesting question, like how much is actually the system of asylums and how much is the mismanagement of resources and so on?
Which is like endemic from all the way through, really, obviously, when you look at this stuff.
Yeah, and it seems to be endemic today. You know, if we had our mental health services properly resourced and facilitated, would those issues that people are wrestling with now still be the same?
Like, I honestly think one of the other things that you'd see change if you properly resource mental health issues is there's a perception. I mean, I've actually, through my work at the university, ended up talking to the council a lot about this, and there's they did a really big project on it. It was quite interesting, about the perceptions of safety in the centre of Ballarat and, you know, where are safe and unsafe places. And I really wonder how much of that perception of unsafety is linked to people with acute mental health issues who are living rough on the streets, and they are the people that people think, oh, you know, I'm going to get mugged, I'm going to get robbed, there's someone dodgy around here. These are people who 50 years ago or even 20 years ago would have been in an asylum somewhere in some sort of treatment and are now receiving virtually nothing and living rough.
Yep. Then, of course, the other issue is the type of treatment they're receiving, because it wasn't really until the 1950s that we have any meaningful psychiatric treatment.
Right. I mean, it's electroshock therapy the 70s or something.
And unlike Europe, Australia never really engaged with psychoanalysis, which was another avenue of care you could have in Europe.
Right.
So here it was, you know, psychiatric treatment or nothing.
Medication.
Yeah, sure. Medication, nothing. And it wasn't really until the discovery of lithium in Australia that any treatment at all was available.
This episode is pretty rough in places. And again, that's that way that it leads us all the way through to 2019, and it doesn't feel fixed in the way that so many other issues we explore do. Like some of the stuff we've looked at before with healthcare around doctors just being unlicensed and medicine being unregulated. That's rectified today. We have a superb system. I mean, medicine today and doctors today compared to what was available in the 1800s is like a different society.
On the positive side, we have better designations of understanding what mental illness is.
Yes.
And there are better treatments available, particularly in terms of, you know, medication and counselling, all those sort of things. I think
the issue remains funding, right?
The issue remains funding. And perhaps some of those earlier issues of, you know, using mental illness as a way of controlling segments of the population by saying they're mad, like suffragettes
right.
and
well,
so on.
Well, we don't do that either.
Yeah, we don't do that anymore. Yeah. So in those fronts, it's improved.
Yeah.
And even being able to quantify when someone is mentally ill or not and so on is much better understood in terms of psychiatry.
Yeah, for sure.
As you say, it's funding is the issue today.
Thank you for listening to our episode. We particularly like to thank our actors, as always. They do incredible work. Katrina Hill is the third part of our podcast team, and she in this episode was voicing Matilda Cutler. She directs our actors. We'd like to thank CIRCA, the Centre for Collaborative Research in Australian History, and Federation University for their support. We'd like to thank our Patreons who help us keep this alive. We are doing this as a hobby, virtually, a project we love doing, but we don't make any money on it. And so they really help us out financially.
After a very grim episode, we do have positive news. We are now finalists in the Ballarat Heritage Awards.
Yes, so we've been shortlisted in the Ballarat Heritage Awards, which is fantastic. And it's such an honour because the other organisations and groups that have been shortlisted are, like, you know, fully professional things that exist around Ballarat. We're talking like the Gold Museum and
professional historical institutions, the Ballarat Mechanics Institute,
William Sky Productions, who do like crazy good documentaries. Like it's amazing.
It's an enormous honour that we're there.
And actually,
if you also feel motivated, you could vote for us on the popular award category when that becomes released in the near future.
Oh, it's part of this.
Yes, we'll put it up on the Facebook page and for the patrons.
That would be weird. Really appreciate your votes. Obviously, thank you. Yes. We'll see it on Facebook.
Thank you very much.
Further materials relating to this and our other episodes, as well as the cast listing, can be found on our website, talesfromratcity.com.